Welcome to the New Mexico News Podcast, headlines and stories from the land of enchantment. Brought to you by KRQE. Here's Chris McKee and Gabrielle Burkhart.
Okay, so Chris is out this week. He's not here for me to put him in the hot seat with a question, but I'm going to go ahead and ask our guests right out of the gate. Put aside today's specific topic for a second. What is the most generous gift that you've ever been given? Has anyone ever gifted anything to you that ended up really coming in handy that you probably wouldn't have gotten for yourself?
When I was like 16, my grandparents gave me a car. Like, they had this old truck that they had, and I wasn't expecting to get a car. My family isn't wealthy, and I knew like kids in my high school were getting cars, but I never expected that. And for my 16th birthday, they drove up and they were like, this is yours. And I was so excited and shocked. And it was great. I had it for a while and unfortunately it was stolen.
But oh, man.
Yeah, it was like, I guess, just the most shocking and generous gift, like a whole car. Also had so much freedom and it just, yeah, I would say I think for that.
Okay, that's a really good one. Mine is also related to cars. I remember when I was about to have my first child, very close to giving birth, and my dad came and he's like, are you parked at work today? I need your keys. And he took my keys and got me all new tires because tires are expensive. I would not have bought them by myself. But also he's like, I can't have you like risking a blowout with my new grandchild in the car. And I was like, oh my God, that is so nice. But that was probably one of the, a very generous, unexpected gift I would not have gotten for myself.
Yeah. Mine's a little smaller, but baby related. So I had a baby during COVID. There were no baby showers or any of that kind of thing because everybody was on lockdown. And so I received in the mail something off my baby registry that was from a random high school friend that I hadn't talked to since high school. This is almost 20 years later. And she just said, I know how hard it is to be a new mom and to have a baby. And in the middle of COVID, this must be really, really hard. And it was something simple like pacifiers and just stuff off my registry. But just the thoughtfulness behind that gift was so uplifting and just really enlightening.
Yeah. Gift giving is something that we don't always think about, but sometimes something hits you and you're like, wow, that was really special. And today's topic centers around a very unique gift giving experience. That is organ donation. So it's something a lot of us probably don't give much daily thought about. You know, they ask you if you want to be an organ donor when you get your driver's license. And before I knew somebody personally who needed an organ, that's about the extent of the thinking that I did about it. But before we get into why we're covering this topic today, I want to introduce today's guests. Here in the KRQE studio is Selena Espinoza. She's the External Affairs Director with Donate Life New Mexico and New Mexico Donor Services. And also Victoria Yoakum, an organ donation advocate and a liver transplant recipient. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
We're excited.
So I'll start with Selena first broadly. April is Donate Life Month. We know you both want to educate more people about what that means. But Selena, tell us, what is the mission behind donor services? What is it and why is it so important here in New Mexico?
Simply to save as many lives as possible. Right now, across the nation, there are 100,000 people waiting for a life-saving transplant. And in New Mexico, there's about 600 people who are waiting for a life-saving organ. The more people we can register, the more possibilities there are in getting a donor to a recipient and saving a life. One person can save up to 8 lives through their gifts. And that's just a giant impact you can have on a community. Really think about New Mexico and the need, and it's continuing our culture. Being able to help a family, help somebody like Victoria be here and continue her life and the good that she's doing in the world. And then a lot of our Native American populations are extremely in need. And if we can save just our elders and people who are established, and, you know, there's no hierarchy when it comes to receiving a gift, but being able to give, we can capture that essence of who we are as a people and continue living. And there's just so many inspiring stories around people that give.
You know, it's not something everyone thinks about regularly. You may never think that you'll be someone who needs an organ until you do. In New Mexico, what type of organ is most needed?
Kidneys, by far above and beyond kidneys. So Right now, there is 644 people on our current wait list. 556 of them are waiting for kidneys.
Wow.
Yeah. And so another interesting stat with those numbers is 1 in 5 on the wait list are currently Native American. And with that, 116 of those are waiting for kidneys, 10 livers, 1 heart, and 1 set of lungs.
And why are kidneys so needed?
Because we are, as a population in New Mexico, really predisposed to diabetes. Diabetes often leads to kidney failure, and kidney failure leads to the need for a transplant.
Okay. So before we get into some of the challenges specific to New Mexico, Victoria, I do want to get to you and your story. It seems like organ donation, receiving, giving, it's one of those life events that really marks time, right? Before transplant, life was one way. Afterward, may take on a whole new meaning or chapter. Tell us about your experience in needing and ultimately receiving a new liver.
You're right. My life is completely, completely different. Everything has changed. Nothing is the same in all good ways. So I was diagnosed when I was 5 with the rare liver disease, Wilson's disease. And all it is, it's a genetic disease in which the liver doesn't process copper. And the reason I was diagnosed is because my aunt received a liver transplant when I was 5, and none of us knew what it was from. She woke up one day and she was having liver failure. And the doctors here, I mean, we lack a lot of resources, I think, especially for special cases. And they didn't really tell her what was going on. They knew her liver was failing. She was immediately flown to Colorado to be listed for a transplant and to start that process. And it wasn't until later, after her transplant, they did a biopsy of her liver and it was green from the copper. And that's when we learned that it was from Wilson's disease. And so everybody in our family was tested and I was the only one that also had this disease. And at the time I was told, because I was diagnosed so young, that I should be able to live a normal life, that I should be treated for it and that my whole life I will be able to manage it and that everything will be fine. But it wasn't fine. I always felt sick. Even before I was diagnosed, I had a lot of stomach issues, but after I was diagnosed and I started taking the medication, I just felt worse and worse. And throughout the years, I just felt more and more sick. I would always have to miss out on certain things as a child, like playing sports and like hanging out with friends just because I didn't feel well. And we were told by the doctors, you know, it's normal. Like, she's going through this treatment and she just has to be more careful. But I suffered a lot because I didn't understand it either. As a child, you know, I knew I was sick and I knew I had this thing going on, but I didn't, I guess, comprehend that I was not supposed to be in pain all the time. And I thought it was just normal to feel sick. And so when I got older, I was taking more and more of the medication. And every time I would take it, I would feel really sick. I would throw it up. It would really cause me a lot of pain. And I suspected that I was being overprescribed it. And I would tell my doctors and they would always say, no, you have to take more. Like, you have to keep the treatment. That's what's keeping you alive. And it reached a point where I physically could not take it. Every time I would take it, I would get sick. And I ended up in the emergency room and I was told I was overdosed on it. I had metal poisoning from the medication.
And this is like pain management medication or what kind of medication?
Sorry. The medication was zinc and it was to treat the Wilson's disease. So it chelated the copper out of my body. And when I was young, this wasn't an available medication. There was only one medication that was available because it was a rare disease. And when I got older, I would say about 10, that's when we discovered that zinc could be an easy over-the-counter, cheaper treatment for this disease and it's less hard on the body, but I just don't think it ever agreed with my body. Like, I would always feel sick when I took it. And so the more and more that I took as I got older, I just felt worse and worse. And it was when I was 16 that I found out I was overdosed on it. And since that time, my body was just completely wrecked. I had so many deficiencies and chronic pain all the time. And I think that's kind of when I realized it's not normal to feel sick all the time. It's not normal to have to deal with all of these issues. And I just couldn't seem to get help for it. I went and sought treatment from the medical experts for Wilson's disease in Connecticut. My parents actually moved out there so that I could get treated out there. And they didn't believe that I overdosed on the medication. He said, the doctor I saw said it was impossible and that there's no way that that could have happened. But I couldn't take the medication because of that. Like, my body constantly rejected it. And so he kind of just said, take it when you can. It's better to take it than not take it at all. And so I would probably take it at maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks, when I was supposed to be taking it 3 times a day.
Okay.
And so
what was the turning point for you? I mean, it sounds like you dealt with a lot before ultimately today we're sitting here and I know that you've had the transplant, but what was the turning point then for them to say, no, you need a new liver?
Right. So the turning point, honestly, was me being an end-stage liver failure. My liver was failing and I didn't know it. And I went and saw doctors during the time that it was failing because I felt awful. I lost so much weight rapidly. I couldn't eat. I couldn't even really drink water. I was just so restricted. I couldn't work. I luckily finished school, but after I finished school, I tried to get jobs and I just could never keep them because I was so sick. And the doctors wouldn't really help me. They would kind of just tell me, you have this disease and that's it. Like, that's why you feel this way. I was told a lot that, oh, you're just depressed. You're just anxious. And you're just like, I don't know if it's because I was young or because I was a woman, but I just never was taken seriously for the times I would go in. And I was going into the hospital every few months, if not every month, into the emergency room for severe pain and severe symptoms, nausea, things like that. And so finally, I went to the doctors here one last time. I woke up one day and I was jaundiced. I was yellow. My skin was yellow. And I had ascites. I had a lot of fluid buildup in my abdomen. I looked pregnant. And at the time, I weighed less than 100 pounds. So I knew that something wasn't right. And so I went to the doctors here and they said, there's nothing we can do for you. You need to go home. We don't know why you're coming in to see us. They didn't tell me I was an end-stage liver failure at that time. They said, we don't know what's wrong with you. And so I felt like I was dying. To be completely honest, I thought I was going to die. At the time, I had heard about the Mayo Clinic in Arizona, which is a six-hour drive from here. And so I drove the next day to the Mayo Clinic and I went to the emergency room and they didn't know anything about me. They didn't have any of my medical records. They just saw what my levels were then. I saw that my liver was failing. They saw that I had all the symptoms of it. And they told me I had about a week before my liver was going to be completely gone. And so that's when they started the process of trying to list me and slow down the failure.
So you got on a list, got a liver donation. What was that process like?
Yeah. So when they told me I needed a transplant, it was very shocking. I was told my whole life I would never need one. And I didn't think something was wrong with my liver, which I now looking back, I know is kind of dumb, but I thought something was wrong with my stomach because I couldn't eat anything. All of my symptoms were dietary, gastro related. And so when they told me I didn't handle it well, I was very scared. They told me I only had a week before pretty much I was going to die. And so I was just like, I think it was hard for me to accept. The process for the listing was expedited. I don't know if you know, but when someone wants to be listed for a transplant, they have to go through a very vigorous process of testing and all these different appointments to get them listed. Mine was expedited within like 2 days. So I had all these doctors coming in and out of my room to just like do assessments on me to make sure that I would be healthy enough to recover after the transplant and well enough to recover after the transplant. And so I honestly, to be completely honest, I don't remember what it was like. I was so in shock and just in my mind, I was like, I'll just wait for the liver to come. So my family really helped me. They went to the classes for me. They took care of the appointments for me while I was in the hospital room, but I wasn't well enough mentally or physically to do the stuff that needed to be done. And prior to being listed, my transplant team did try to slow down the failure to buy us time. So when I went in, they told me I had about a week, but I was in the hospital for 18 days. And so they did so many things to try and just buy us time to see if I really did need to be listed or if there was some way that they could maybe do something to fix it. And then ultimately it was found like, no, there's no way she could live with this liver anymore. And so I was listed on June 10th and then it was June 17th that I got the liver. So I was only listed for a week.
What year was this?
2022. So it's almost been 2 years now.
Wow. Okay. And how old were you when this was happening?
Yeah, I was 23.
Wow.
Yeah, when I got my liver. So now I'm almost 25 and yeah, my whole life is completely different. I woke up from the transplant and I literally felt better than I ever had in my whole life.
Oh my gosh.
It was crazy.
I think that's a big misconception is that, you know, you hear somebody needs a liver or a kidney transplant. And a lot of the times it's thought immediately like they're an alcoholic or they've done something to kind of ruin their organs. And in our state, we see over and over repeatedly, that's a misconception. There are genetic diseases, there's predisposition, all these different things that go into needing a transplant and needing an organ donation.
It's so true. Even now, people, when I tell them I had a transplant, they automatically assume it was because of alcohol. And so I started to joke about it. Like, I'll tell people that that's why it's for, and they're like, really? And I'm like, no, but even if it was, even if it is because of that, that doesn't mean that that person is less deserving of an organ, especially their process that they have to go through to be listed is even harder because they have to get help with their alcoholism and get help with that recovery first. And so to be able to go through that and then go through the process of waiting for a transplant, it's so, I admire those sort of people. But she's right. I'm very young for my transplant. I was the youngest, I think, that they had seen recover so quickly. And they were all very shocked that I would need a transplant considering that I was diagnosed so young. And it was just a big shock, I think, for everybody. And so now, because of my age, that's why I want to bring awareness to transplant, to organ donation, because I think people my age don't know all that it entails. I think they've heard about it. And like you said, they go to the MVD and they know that, but they don't actually see people like me have had their lives changed and saved from something like this.
First of all, so glad you're here telling your story 2 years later. But also, what a frustrating portion of that story to hear that you had to drive yourself to another state to get someone to take you seriously for your medical issues. And I wanted to touch on that just a little bit. Some of the challenges that we have here in New Mexico, you know, we're in a unique state when it comes to our demographics and our geographics, right? We have a densely populated Albuquerque where our two main hospitals are. We have the University of New Mexico Hospital and Presbyterian. We also have rural parts of the state that require a lot more driving to get to. Then there are pueblos and sovereign nations. Selena, does the geography of our state present specific challenges when it comes to organ donation?
Yes. So donor heroes, the way it works is if the federal government is required to tell our nonprofit, and we are a local nonprofit, so we really work in our communities, understand our state, work with the local doctors. I think that's displaced as well, is people don't understand that there's a local nonprofit here working hard to save lives through organ donation. But we work closely with Presbyterian and UNMH, and they only have kidney transplant programs. So if you need a liver, a heart, lungs, something else, you are traveling to that location. Oftentimes that's Texas, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, and you as a recipient must be within 3 hours of that facility to be able to receive. So like Victoria, if she would have gotten a call and lived in Albuquerque and her liver's ready in Arizona and it takes her 6 hours to get there, it's not going to work. So it's cost prohibitive to some families. It's, you know, something that they accrue as they're figuring out how to get their loved ones transplanted. But for donor heroes as well, the federal government is required to tell our nonprofit when there is a person in the hospital that dies in a way that makes donation possible. So most often that results in somebody being brain dead. You're on a breathing machine, they got you to the hospital, but you're no longer there, only your body is there. And so if that person is registered, that's kind of easier in the process for your family and for our organization. We simply come along the bedside and walk the family through the donation process. If you're not registered, we then go and approach the family and say, have you ever thought about this? Like, is it something you would consider? Have you considered the impact or the legacy that your loved one might leave and live on? And so we then would walk the process with that family, whether they say yes or no. But you think about somebody that like lives in Farmington and their loved one gets medevaced quickly to UNMH. Well, then they're driving from Farmington to support that donor hero, or maybe it's somebody who's waiting for a transplant. They have to go somewhere else if it's not kidneys. We see too, in being listed for transplant, there are certain requirements that you have to have. You have to have running water. You have to have access to electricity. You have to be able to make it to a hospital to get weekly tests to make sure you're not in rejection. And for a lot of our rural communities, especially tribal communities, that's hard. We don't often think that there are still places in New Mexico that don't have electricity and running water, but there are, and those communities are in dire need.
Or even being able to afford the medication, and the medication can be costly if you don't have good coverage and good support.
So when you gave the hypothetical of, say, she was trying to get a liver in New Mexico, but she wouldn't even be able to be listed then because of those.
Yeah, we only do kidney transplants Wow. in New Mexico.
Okay. And then your organization basically helps connect all the parties.
Yeah. So we facilitate the donor heroes, work alongside the bedside of the family. We work through an agency, the National Waitlist, to find the match and the recipient for that organ. Then we facilitate the transport of that organ. So it could be driving a kidney to Colorado or driving a liver to Arizona, flying a heart. We flew a heart to Boston last year. And we also coordinate the transplant teams. So donation within the hospitals is something they do on top of their everyday duties, and they do it extra to be able to help save lives. But it's not like a regularly scheduled routine kind of surgery. So we coordinate the transplant staff, and then we have aftercare resources where families, even donors and recipients, have grief services. We facilitate when you see those amazing stories of a recipient and a donor family meeting for the first time. We facilitate that and the communication between families, and then offer some counseling and grief resources.
Okay. So is this a national organization? Do you have access to, like, who needs a kidney in Colorado, for instance?
Yeah, we tie into the national database, UNOS. UNOS runs that database, and then we help facilitate that match and do what we call allocation. So when we have a donor hero, say we have two kidneys and a liver that are going to be given by that donor hero, we start making offers out to the different hospitals, and so that they can run the checks and the balances on their lists to see who the recipients would be. Here's kind of a stunning conundrum. In New Mexico, we make about 4,000 offers before a kidney is accepted. So you think about somebody who's been on a national wait list. In New Mexico, the average is 5 years. And to hear that we had to offer that kidney 4,000 times before somebody says yes.
Why? Why is that?
It can be lots of things. The main one is transplant doctors are graded on their success rates. So if they get a kidney that's not 100% performing, maybe it's like at a 75, they can say yes or no based on what they know about that organ and what our team has discovered about that organ and based on what they know about their patient. So would it be a good match? Is it the perfect match? Some doctors are very aggressive and say, I will take a chance on that 75% kidney. We'll take it. Let's go. Others say, nope, we're going to wait for a 100% performing kidney before we get that transplanted. So it just depends on the doctor and the allocation process. But it's something that we see as New Mexico Donor Services, which can sometimes be a little frustrating. Our lungs, especially because we're at such a high altitude, can be sometimes marginal. But you take that set of lungs to sea level and it performs great.
Interesting.
But it's just the different dynamic. And so it's educating not only the community, but our partners on what the health of our organs looks like, what the recipients, you know, side of things might be, and just a lot of coordination and working together.
When I was told that I was going to need a transplant and I was going to be listed, I was asked if by the Mayo Clinic if I would accept a liver that was HIV positive, because the Mayo Clinic is able to treat HIV and cure it now.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and I said, yes, of course. I'm like, I'll take what I can get, you know, and luckily I didn't, but I do know people from support group that did get organs, livers from HIV positive people, and they're perfectly fine. I think that the standards, like you said, it's per hospital, but the standards have changed because of the need. And honestly, I can't imagine. I know people that have gotten offers and then the offers just don't work out, or they take them back, or it's not a match. I cannot fathom having to go through that. I can't fathom having to wait years, even waiting a week. And I am so privileged because I was listed A1 status, number one in the country, but it was so grueling just sitting there waiting, knowing that if I didn't get this, that I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't live. So it's really crazy to know the behind the scenes.
And I also have a little bit of personal experience that, you know, if you've got a very specific medical need, you go outside of New Mexico to get care and treatment. Quick personal story I will share briefly since we're talking about it. My dad was diagnosed with AML leukemia when my daughter was one. He ended up needing a bone marrow transplant. So a lot of the family were tested. He was one of five children. So all his siblings were tested. I was tested, all trying to see if any of us were a match. I was a half match. So I ended up being his bone marrow donor. And this was pre-pandemic. So right before, like, you know, the world shut down, we were traveling and flying a lot from Albuquerque to UT Southwestern in Dallas, where they ultimately did that transplant. But it really opened my eyes a lot to how this works, right? The systems that all have to be in place and everybody who has to be communicating for things to work out for the patient. And when I say work out, I mean live. Like, this is life or death, right? And I know there were times my dad was ready to throw in the towel, challenges we had to overcome. We had to move him to Texas because, like Selena was saying, you have to be within a certain radius for them to even do the transplant. So we had to rent an apartment. We had to raise funds and figure out, you know, who was going to be his 24-hour caregiver for 90 days when no one can just quit their job for 90 days. So many barriers that you have to overcome to just get to that point. Thankfully, I can say today he's back to work, cancer-free. He has a new birthday, if you will. You're probably familiar, the day of the transplant. And, you know, that experience changed a lot for him and me. I know that he's not the first person who's needed something like that. But I wanted to ask you guys, you know, when somebody is not an immediate match, thank God I was, you know, a half match, but there are hundreds of people who go on waiting lists for organ donations, right? How does the process work out for most folks when they're just put on a waiting list and waiting for a match? Is it automatically uploaded into a national database? Can you give us just the basics?
Yeah, it's automatically uploaded to that database. Then you're listed on criteria depending on how sick you are. Your age does factor into it. And then your blood type factors into it because certain blood types are easier to match. And then certain blood types are harder to match. So pediatric patients get first priority. And then it just depends. We had a donor case 2 years ago where a woman in Colorado needed a liver and the family knew they had been praying for this woman. They were able to direct donate the liver of the donor hero. Her name is Kelly Engel. She was able to give her liver to this woman that her family had been praying for like 3 years that needed a liver in Colorado. And it was literally a God thing where they happened to be a perfect match, but it happened to be that Kristen, the recipient, was so sick the day before that they were afraid she wasn't going to survive the surgery. So there's so many factors into that. And they ended up praying for her and they say it's a miracle that Kristen was able to then receive because she literally recovered the next day to be well enough to receive the liver. But it's a funny algorithm of how it all stacks up. The thing to note though is that, you know, you can't buy your way to the top of that wait list. You're not, you know, Mariah Carey's not going to get a liver before Victoria.
Well, if she does, we'll be covering it.
But the algorithm is very set and very specific. So it's followed across the nation.
I also know that I was listed A1 because of a lot of reasons, but I know that me being in the hospital, me actually being hospitalized did help me get it faster. And then, yeah, my age and what the condition was. There's so many things that decide it. But I do know of people who've had living donor transplants, which is amazing to think that even if you're listed pretty low, you can still reach out to family members or friends and see if they're matches. And it, of course, depends on a lot of things, depends on how sick you are, if you are able to go through that process, because that process is a whole other set of time. And as I'm sure as you know, but I know that that's also an option for people who may not be listed very high.
Yeah.
So something really cool, your liver regenerates. So if you donate part of your liver as a living donor, it will not only grow back with inside of you, but then in the recipient, it grows to accommodate what that body needs. And then obviously you can be a living kidney donor and donate one of your kidneys. And it doesn't even have to be to somebody you know. Maybe you just want to do something good in the world and give that gift of life. All you do is contact UNM or Presbyterian and they'll figure out how to get you listed and transplant if you want to.
I know a few great stories. I know someone in my support group who got a transplant, a liver transplant, and her mom was so inspired and so grateful that her daughter's life was saved that she donated a kidney, which is awesome. And then I know of someone from social media that just had a living donor liver transplant and her donor, this was maybe 4 months ago, and her donor just ran a marathon, like almost fully recovered, feeling great, no lasting issues from the transplant. And she just ran a marathon for the American Liver Foundation. So it's, I think there's some misconceptions like, well, if I donate an organ or donate some of my organ, then I will have issues, which is not true. And also I read somewhere that if the person who donates a kidney, for example,
would eventually need a kidney transplant, that they'll be priority listed.
Yeah. One of my really good friends in Texas actually donated a kidney to her mom too. And it was very eye-opening. Again, it's like, you don't need two of those like to live. You're okay. Yeah. She's totally doing fine. She's a mom of two now, doing great. Also, I wanted to ask, Selena, you mentioned to me, I think before we did this interview, that the wait list though has grown over the years, right? Why is that?
Well, it's coming down slowly but surely. So it was at 120,000 people 2 years ago. It's at 100,000 people across the US now. We like to say 100 lives are saved every day because of organ donation, but also somebody's added to the national wait list every 20 minutes. So it's just that juxtaposition. And
it's a big demand.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially with deceased donors, we're not in control of that. And all we can do is ask that you make your wishes known by either registering or telling your family what you would like to have happen if you're ever in that scenario, because they are going to have to make the decision. So whether it's a yes or whether it's a no, your family needs to know.
Okay. Do you know who donated the liver to you?
Unfortunately, no. And I'm sorry if I get emotional. I don't know who it is. I was told after my transplant that it was a male and he was a little older than me, in his mid-30s, and that he died from a traumatic brain injury that wasn't a car accident. So that's all I know. I wrote a letter to his family at the end of last year. You know, every holiday that passes by, I can't help but think, you know, I'm here with my family and I get to celebrate, but this person is missing from their family. And on Thanksgiving last year, I really was a mess the whole day, just like so grateful that I get to, you know, my sister just had a baby and I get to be there with her and her baby. And this person, I don't know if they had kids, and what if, you know, they did and their kids are missing them. And so I decided to write after that around Christmas. And I just told them, you know, how grateful I was. I told them about all the work I'm doing with donor services to try and bring awareness. And I guess telling them that I'm living a good life, like I'm being healthy. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I take care of the gift I was given. And I told them if he wanted to climb a mountain or run a marathon or do something, that I would do it for him, because, you know, my life is so much better now. It's so transformed. So unfortunately, no. I really hope that I get to know them one day and meet them. I see all those videos of donor family meeting the recipient and I sob, because I want to be able to thank them and show them, you know, what kind of person I am. So not yet.
That's really special. Thank you for sharing that. So then the letter went to his family, but you haven't heard back yet?
Yeah. And I mean, I can't blame them. The happiest, best thing to happen to me. But for them, I know it's not. I know it's probably one of the worst things to happen. And I know that everybody's grieving process is different. From the people that I have spoken to who are in contact with their donor families, it took a few years, or it took a few letters even. We are allowed to write as many times as we like. We can't share any personal information, so I didn't tell them my name or anything like that, or any identifying factors. I was able to tell them that I'm from New Mexico and that my age, but it's up to them to write back and for them to kind of make the decision to if they want to have that. But I do know that they do receive the letters, and we are told that a lot of the times it does help with their grieving process to know that their family member saved someone's life and that this person is living on through them.
Wow. We've talked about some of the challenges that our state faces, right? And we all live here. New Mexico's a beautiful state. There are great things about it. I think we can all admit there are challenges, right? Is there anything that you guys, in a quick bullet point list, think that we need to do better at as a state? Do we need more providers, more hospitals equipped with specialists? How can New Mexico better serve people here?
Absolutely more specialists, more doctors. I am in the healthcare world. I have my biochemistry degree, and before my transplant, I was pre-med. And so I've had a lot of jobs in the hospital, and I've shadowed a lot of doctors, and I always see the disparities. And it's not the doctor's fault. It's, you know, lack of resources, lack of access to things that maybe other, like the Mayo Clinic might have or Colorado might have. But as somebody who was a rare disease patient, I felt like I was drowning. I felt like I needed so much help and there was nobody around to help me. And I do know I am very, very fortunate that I could afford to go out of state and that I could afford to live by the Mayo Clinic for a while I went through the whole process. But I also know that there are a lot of people who can't afford that and can't afford to
go somewhere else to get the help that they need, and then they just end up not making it. So I do think that access to better resources and then more providers and more specialty providers, definitely.
I would say education is really key. We're going to launch a grant later this year to study how many people who are currently on dialysis are actually being told that they could receive a transplant, a kidney transplant. And if they are being told, how? Like, are they being told in Spanish? Do we have any Native American type cultural sensitive communications? Are they just getting a paper in their packet? How are we approaching people to get them to know that, one, transplantation works, two, you can receive a directed donation or even have a living donor, and then three, you could be a donor, sign up, register. What does that entail? I think we've talked about cost a lot, and it's important to emphasize that there's not a cost to the donor's family and to the donor themselves. So we're very interested to see what, especially within our rural communities, is being communicated when it comes to transplantation and helping people.
I don't even know if people know, but you can actually list yourself. You can go to, depending on the hospital, like the Mayo Clinic has a website where you can go if you want to go through the evaluation to be listed. You don't have to wait for like a referral or anything like that. You can do it yourself. I mean, I went into the emergency room. I mean, I didn't know I needed a transplant, but I know of other recipients that went that way. They knew they were going to need a transplant, so they just went into the emergency room and asked if they could go through the process. And I think, yeah, there is a lot of misinformation and miseducation about organ donation. I've heard some myths, so I would agree that a lack of education is a big factor.
And I will say that there are people trying in our state. So UNM is looking to open a liver transplant program. They've talked to a bunch of different doctors and, you know, are looking into what that might look like. And then Presbyterian has recently started transplanting pancreases as well. So there is some momentum in the right trajectory. It just comes down to resources, you know, and getting those qualified doctors here and providing the resources that they need for those programs.
It's very encouraging to be at the hospitals and to know that the staff is excited. They want to help. They want to be a part of this. But like Selena said, it's just the resources, and I guess that's holding them back. I think even if we aren't able to get, for example, a liver transplant program here, a heart transplant, even a resource that may help patients go out of state, travel out of state, whether it be like a foundation to provide housing for them or the resources that they'll need after, I think would be extremely beneficial.
We just started a birth tissue program, which is huge. So Victoria actually is our birth tissue coordinator. And so birth tissue, your placenta on a scheduled C-section, which would just be thrown away as medical waste normally, can now be donated. And a one placenta graft can help up to 100 people.
So I am a birth tissue recovery coordinator now. I started working for New Mexico Donor Services, I think almost 2 months ago. It was really my goal after my transplant. Just seeing how much my life was impacted and how much my life was improved, I knew what I wanted to do was help other people like me and help give people hope and educate people. And so almost immediately I became an ambassador for Donor Services, and I spoke at some events last year with them, and that's how Selena and I became connected. And then eventually I started applying to jobs there. And then when this job came up, Selena put in a good word for me. And that's how I started doing this. But I am so like honored to be a part of Donor Services and to see, I guess, the direct result of what we're doing actually helping people. And I like to say that our birth tissue program is the happier side of organ donation. You know, we get to see babies come into the world. Other people's lives are saved and improved through the placenta donation. And like Selena said, they're thrown away as medical waste anyway. And so to know that we can actually do something with them that's so beneficial to people that really need them is just so amazing.
Well, Victoria and Selena, thank you so much for joining me today. Appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Selena Espinoza and Victoria Yoakum for coming on the podcast and sharing with us about organ donation and some of the challenges that New Mexico faces when it comes to this. If you have a story idea, feel free to reach out. I'm gabrielle.burkhardt@krqe.com. Obviously, you guys have noticed Chris McKee is not here this week, and I want to give him and his wife, Rebecca, a quick shout out. They are now parents. Congratulations, McKee family. We are so happy for you. And soak it all in. Soak in the newborn stages. It's going to be a whirlwind, but we are so happy for you. So Chris is out. I am still here. Feel free to reach out if you've got a story idea or a topic you'd like to hear about on our podcast. Also, I'm G Burke NM on social media. Thank you all for listening.